The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Paul Scott of Stockopedia, one of the UK's finest small and micro-cap investors. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul, and hi to everyone. Great to be back.
Yeah, well, big congrats on your year-to-date portfolio performance, which I think is sort of like 30% plus year-to-date versus AIM down sort of 10%. Indeed, I think you've had a pretty good last 15 years since the financial crisis. So just broadly for investors, what's sort of the magic formula, the Scotty secret sauce behind the sort of stock-picking success over the last sort of 15 years? What are the key traits?
Well, I think that's a bit of an edited highlights version of my career, actually, Paul. I've had some absolute disasters along the way. But the main mistakes I've made were all concerning gearing. So I've just decided now, you know, I've had fabulous returns from geared accounts for years, but then you'll just hit a bear market and everything just gets totally screwed up. So that side of things was a total roller coaster ride, but I've stopped gearing altogether now. So my ungeared portfolio is relatively small compared with the money I had last year when I lost nearly all the money in the spread betting accounts.
I'm glad you gave that up.
I shouldn't be laughing, but you know, it's the best way to just draw a line under it and move on, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
things go wrong in all our lives. So I don't think there's really any secret sauce. I mean, I redid my numbers this morning since I took over running a SIP myself, which was in 2012. And actually, this is a really good tip for people. If you've got lots of little pensions lying around that are just dormant from previous jobs, consolidate them into a SIP, and which is what I did. And I was really surprised at how much money was there when I did this in 2012, and it was money I'd forgotten I had. So that was a good start. And since then, since 2012, the money I had in the SIP, I've six-bagged it.
Wow.
Which works out at, with no extra money going in, that was just a frozen portfolio, it's six bagged in 10 years. And that works out at a compound annual gain of 17%, which I think was up from 14% last time we spoke, because I've had a really strong year this year, but a terrible year last year when it went down. So I think if you can compound at anything in the teens or above, you're going to make serious money long term. I put the numbers into a spreadsheet. It's staggering how these amounts compound, you know, over 10, 15, 20 years.
No, so I would agree.
There's no need to use gearing. You know, you can just by being more sensible and trying to out. And I think 20% per annum in small caps is doable. I know plenty of people who, a few dozen people I know have achieved that sort of 20%-ish gain compound year in, year out. Well, they'll have the odd year where they make 100%, you know, and the odd year where they make minus 20. But if you can, so I think there's great money to be made in small caps longer term.
And what's the sweet spot? Is it looking at sort of value plays, or is it looking for GARP stocks, growth stocks, or a bit of everything?
I don't know. It's difficult to say, isn't it? The market goes through different patches where different strategies perform differently. I mean, I tend to just boil it down to the individual company level. I think in good markets or bad, there will always be some companies putting out really strong results and outlooks who buck the trend. Mm. Obviously, it's a smaller percentage of stocks that are doing that right now. But one of the readers on Stockopedia put up a couple of lists of, you know, shares that have done very well over the last 12 months, and there are plenty of them. So, for me, I'm just a stock picker. I look at the individual shares and I try and find stuff that's relatively small where nobody's really looking. You know, there's not any broker coverage where they'll particularly in bear markets at the moment, they'll put out positive trading updates, the nice strong outlook. You know, you compare it with the last one and you can see a change in tone. Big substantial director buying, I think, can often be a good signal. So I'm really looking for individual stocks that I think will outperform in any market.
What about the sort of the importance of sort of resilience in down markets? Because I mean, just broadly, sort of the hit rate, if you go into smaller microcaps, anything more than 60%, you're doing pretty well, actually. That's industry leading, particularly if you've got sort of like a few big winners that, along the way, which tends to be the case to sort of counteract the losers. So if that's a sort of like the hit rate, sort of like you're wrong a third of the time at least then yeah. you're going to have to go through some pretty tough periods. And so resilience, how important do you think resilience is when you go through these sort of bear markets?
Well, actually, I've learned, I think, quite a bit in the last year or two from my mistakes. And whereas I always used to just stubbornly stick with things, once I'd done my research, you know, I would say, the market's wrong, I'm right. And
I've been there.
And, yeah. And it doesn't, quite often it doesn't end well.
No.
So what I've decided to do now is just be a bit more ruthless with positions. I'm trying not to form sort of quite extreme or strident views on stocks. I'm trying to look at both sides. We're continuously learning, aren't we, Paul? All of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been doing this, as you say, 25, 30 years each. Yeah. And you learn every day. That's why it's so fascinating. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely being less stubborn, less dogmatic about stock picks. And I'm looking at my portfolio. And when I want to buy something, like my current biggest holding that we'll talk about in a minute, you know, I'm having to look at all the other positions and say, well, something's got to go. And I've been quite ruthless in just chopping out things that, you know, where I've just been stubborn and got it wrong so far.
Yeah, good. Okay. And then just in terms of sort of broadly for small and micro caps, we've had a really bad period of sort of like, you know, underperformance from AIM. I think it's down over 40% since its peak in 2021.
It is. Yeah, so we've had a two-year bear market down 43% from August 2021, which I'm staggered at. I mean, I didn't think it would be. And the interesting thing is that I can't remember a time when the AIM market and the small caps generally were such an outlier. You know, normally when you look at the bear markets, the FTSE halves, doesn't it? Like it did in 2001, 2002. The FTSE and the Dow and all those things crashed in 2008 and take small caps with them. But this time around, actually, the bigger indices, America and over here and in Germany and elsewhere, seem to be holding up really well. But the small caps have absolutely plummeted. Well, that gap, to me, is my opportunity.
Mean reversion.
Yes, mean reversion. Yeah. I mean, okay, you look at 2021, there was lots of stuff we all got a bit overexcited about, wasn't there, with hindsight? Yes. and I think you've got the structural problem at the moment where a lot of these small cap funds are facing big redemptions, and you can't blame the fund holders who look at how badly they've performed and want their money out. And of course, there's no liquidity. They can't sell a lot of these positions. So you could have overhangs, I think, in some small cap shares for a year or more, possibly.
Yeah, yeah. I have
but
the
again,
same.
That it's throwing bargains at us. So we can take our pick. We can be highly selective. And this is where I think you and I and the listeners, we lay the groundwork for big gains once this market turns, which it always does. We've seen quite a few cycles over the years, and it always does turn. And 2 years into a nasty bear market, you're definitely nearer the end than you are the beginning, aren't you?
Yeah.
Of the bear market.
Oh, so when do you think the tide will turn on the on sort of AIM and small caps then? Is it early next year?
I think it might be starting to happen already, selectively. I'm starting to see some sort of little green shoots of company, good, decent companies that are really bombed out in valuation that are warning on profits again. And, you know, they spike down 20%, but then they kind of recover some or all of the way within days. I mean, a good recent example of that was Enerqua, which I think you're quite familiar with. The Headlam, the carpets distributor, a similar sort of thing, absolutely crashed on a profit warning, but buyers came in and they've held it. So things like that are starting. Plus, of course, all these takeover bids. We had another one this morning, didn't we?
Ergomed.
Pemira Private Equity. So the private equity guys are happy to pay quite full valuations for structural growth companies, I think, aren't they? Yeah. So I'm looking a bit more at that area as well. I'm naturally drawn towards value. But I think actually, you know, if you see structural growth, the company's consistently doing well. I mean, Ergomed was a 10-bagger from 2019 to 2021. Wow. So yeah, amazing. Unfortunately, I didn't pick up on that one. I don't know how it slipped through the net, but you can't pick up on everything, can you?
No, you've had a pretty good year, so you don't want to get too greedy.
I don't want to sound like I'm crowing just over having, you know, seven.
No, you're not doing that. No.
Months after a disastrous 2022, so I deserve a little bit of luck, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean I think that's an important trait, isn't it? It's sort of like you know, you're not as good as your finest hour, and you're not as bad as the darkest moments. I think that's key for investors. You need some sort of emotional stability to take you through the good times and the bad times, because you can get a bit over your skis when everything's going well. But let's be clear about it, a third of my selections at least go south, and therefore, you know, you're wrong a lot of the time, and you've got to then be able to get through the down times as well as the sort of, like, you know, you don't have a Christmas every time you make a winner.
Yeah, I think those are very wise words, Paul. I agree with all of that. I think one of the things I've noticed from the reader comments on the daily reports I write on Stockopedia is that, you know, a lot of the, especially the newer subscribers, are so despondent and are so down, you know, and they're really feeling emotional, quite serious emotional pain from the losses. And I do think sharing people's troubles with other investors on forums where people are going to be constructive and helpful is actually very valuable, you know, and a bit of we're all in this together, you know, we've all suffered substantial losses over the last couple of years, is quite helpful.
Trouble
shared and all that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I've got similar sort of long-term returns as yourself, sort of like mid-teens, which I'm delighted with over sort of 25, 30 years. However, I've had large drawdowns, and the latest one was obviously, you know, the pandemic. And, you know, like everybody else, you know, I lost seven figures in a month, you know. Yeah. So, but that's not dissimilar to a lot of other people, because, you know, in percentage terms, everybody got absolutely stuffed at the start of 20, because I was enlightened in value. So, but you have to get through it. And it's a matter of looking where you currently are, sifting through your portfolio, which one are your strongest you want to keep. If you need, making sure that there's anything there you want to eject and get rid of because you don't think it's going to get over the valley, and then concentrate, free up some money and concentrate on where the bargains are. If that's baby in the bathwater stuff, which I think you're brilliant at, because that's exactly what you did last year after a bad year. You got through the dark moments and then have come out this side 12 months on, and everything's turned quite quickly. And hopefully for people who have similarly suffered over the last 2 years, next year could be their banner year.
Yes, no, all very sensible stuff, Paul, definitely. And I think the other thing I found, when you've had a really, really dire year, as I did last year, because mainly because of the gearing, but also because everything was dropping, I think there's a lot to be said for just wiping the slate clean and chucking everything out that's causing me anxiety. You know, if I'm
as long as it isn't everything.
Yeah, but not particularly, say, over the balance sheet, you know. Yeah. I just decided I didn't want any more 70, 80, 90% falls on anything. So I just selected some fresh ideas of new stocks that, you know, were obviously oversold. And I made sure I was buying stuff with bulletproof balance sheets, you know, maybe get some divvies as well. And I think, you know, you can rebuild, and it'll take time. The one thing that so many investors lack, and I think the thing we all need to learn from really, is just to be more patient. This is a long-term game. We're trying to build up pots for our retirement in 20, 30, 40 years' time, or whatever it is. And you don't need to make spectacular percentage gains each year. Just, you know, if you're even doing sort of 7, 8, 9% per annum, you compound that, and it'll deliver a really good result. So I think this is why it's so important for youngsters, you know, people just starting out in their working career, saving $1,000 or $2,000 a year into a pension scheme. You know, they'll be really glad they've done that later in life.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Very wise words. You know, sort of like a patience equals profits, doesn't it? Yeah. Because they're seamless, they're both sides of the equal sign. Now let's shoot to one of your latest investment that you explained, I think, on your podcast on Saturday, Plexus.
Yes.
And in fact, I think you pushed the share price up this morning, actually, Paul. So
possibly. Well, I mean, I've been buying this since I think it was on the 21st of August. It came out with a very, very interesting RNS, Plexus Holdings, absolute nano cap. I mean, the market cap, there's about 100 million shares in issue. It was about 4p. And I just read the last, you know, the last five or six trading updates and contract win announcements. It doesn't take long. You know, there's not many of them there. But they're full of little nuggets of really quite promising sounding stuff, like a record contract win of £5 million was announced in March. And in June, I think it was, they announced that contract had gone up to £8 million. That's the biggest ever contract the company's ever had.
They do sort of like wellhead, sort of like oiling. Well, it's basically largely for gas to stop methane leaking from oil and gas wells, yeah. Don't they?
Yeah, it's high-end wellheads for the oil and gas extraction industry. They've been quite widely used in the North Sea, I believe. And Plexus was profitable, and I think it had a market cap of around about £200 million. Pounds back in 2015, it was making £5 million a year profit, has patented IP. Then it all started to go wrong in 2015, and basically there was just a drought of drilling for oil and gas as this whole ESG business took hold, and the whole industry now is under-resourced, and we're now coming into a cyclical upturn. This is why lots of oil services companies are reporting, you know, much, much stronger outlooks. So I think this is a good sector play generally. And Plexus, I think, was ridiculously oversold. It's 59% owned by management, who are the founders. The CEO's been there for 37 years, I think, or something. Totally, totally passionate about the company. He's propped it up personally with £2.5 million in cash injected into the business in a convertible loan and buying a long leasehold property because he believes in it. And, you know, he could have taken it private for peanuts a year ago, but he seems very committed to the listing and to the company generally, and it's landed this major contract win, which Cenkos says will actually make it profitable in the current financial year. It's been running about £4 million a year losses for the last 7 years. Now, amazingly, they got through that without actually any dilution. So the CEO really jealously guards the share count, as founder managers often do. And as I say, we can't be sure at the moment. It was one contract, doesn't make a boom, does it? But
no.
Certainly the signs are there. When you put it together with, for example, a big deal it's got with Schlumberger,
yeah.
On licensing. Yeah, and they've just renewed it for another 6 years. And basically a three-year non-compete agreement with Technip expired. And Schlumberger has been developing the next generation of Plexus wellheads, which are, I believe, are going to be launched quite soon. And, you know, Schlumberger, what, 100 billion oil services giant?
I mean, basically Schlumberger, and well known in the oil and gas services industry, has been the technical leader.
Interesting. Yeah.
By a mile, more than Halliburton and all the other guys. They've got the best technology. 50% of their business is all tech. Now, the sort of key question for investors on Plexus is, it obviously the technology and the patented technology has been around for, you know, at least 10 years or so.
Oh, yeah, more than that.
What sort of like triggered this sort of inflection point of sort of like the upswing? And likewise, how leading edge is the technology still compared to sort of the competition?
I'm not a sector expert, Paul, so I'm going to, you know, admit my own limitations on this. But so I look for sort of external signals that tell me this is good. So really the key one is that Schlumberger have licensed it and then have then extended that license from 3 years to another 6 years to 2029 and are funding and developing a whole range of products using Plexus's IP, which tells you that the IP is good, is tight, you know, is patented. There's a new family of patents that Plexus are about to file, which they say will give them another 20 years of what they're doing. They've got quite a big in-house R&D team, so they're continuously refining and developing it within Plexus. So I just think, you know, this we got that validation that this tech is is good, and Plexus should receive. I've seen figures of between 3% and 6% royalties from Schlumberger, and I believe the wellheads are kind of $1 million or $1 million a pop. Yeah. So they'll be selling globally. So the big unknown at the moment is what these what the royalty stream will be for Plexus. And I wouldn't even begin to want to guess at that. It's just an unknown. It's a known unknown. But when I was buying Plexus's market cap, when I started buying at 5p a share, the market cap was 5 million, you know, and it's risen now to 12p a share. And so it's still only 12 million market cap. And it peaked at over 200 million.
You've already one bagged or two bagged on it. So it's not
one bagged, but I mean, I'm not in it for 10 or 12p. You know, I think if this works, it's 50p to a quid. Yeah. But there's no guarantee. You know, I can't say that's definitely going to happen. I don't know. My time machine is in for servicing. I can't visit the future, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, it's up 28% today. So
I mean, it's the only thing that bothered me. I mean, I've bought quite a big chunk of these. I had to break it down into about 30 or 40 individual transactions. So I was just nibbling at it.
Yeah.
And you know, stocks coming from somewhere. I don't know who's selling. I haven't seen any RNSs. But with management owning 59%, that means the free float. Everybody else is only about 4 million quid. And you know, the trades are just steaming through constantly. I've stopped buying now because I ran out of money. So I think I stopped buying at about 9.5p, just literally because I put everything into it that isn't in my other core positions. And I just hope to God it works. But you know, I am a risk taker. I will take a calculated risk. This may well be too illiquid and too risky for lots of your listeners. So it's these are not recommendations. We're just flagging up, you know, ideas for people to research.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things, isn't it, the beauties of what you do and what I do. It's a lot of idiosyncratic risk that we don't go for this sort of, like, you know, broad brush index style portfolio. We go for ones we specifically have high conviction plays, and clearly I'll have a good look at Plexus myself now. Moving to
so Paul, just on concentration, so you're normally quite concentrated, aren't you? So where do you stand on that at the moment?
I think I'll have to check, but I think I own about 12 or 13 stocks, a couple of big ones. I've got about 21% cash at the moment, which looking to deploy into stocks and shares. I typically, you know, I'll hold for 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, whatever it is. Sometimes you don't get a chance because it's sort of like it's either might be taken over or alternatively your thesis doesn't run through. But I'm prepared to hold thick and thin, as in, like, you know, until the investment thesis is broken, then I typically retain it in my portfolio. What about you? About you? How many stocks do you own?
But it's pretty similar, actually, about 12 to 15. I'm concentrating heavily when I find something that I think is a real, you know, when risk reward I think is really favorable. I tend to put 30, 40, even 50% of my money into one stock.
How much have you put into Plexus so far?
10%
plus.
I'd rather not say, but it's a lot more than 10%.
Okay, well, you'll be disclosing your 3% position probably soon then.
I'm over 2%.
Well, that gives us a good idea anyway.
Yeah, so it's really, you know, it's, but also I think you've got a plan for the downside, haven't you? So if something calamitous happened with Plexus, I've worked out the numbers so that it wouldn't kill me. It would be a disaster, but the remaining portfolio would be okay. You know, I think a lot of people say, oh, you know, I was talking to a reader the other day who was saying he was averaging down on something. And he says, oh, I've worked on my break-even price. And it was some absolute pile of junk. And I said to him, you know, you shouldn't be trying to work out your average, your break-even price. You should be working out what your loss would be if it goes to zero. That's the key number, isn't it, to have in your
head? I mean, that's a really, really key point, because a lot of investors fall into that trap, doubling down on stocks they've got wrong, but they don't admit they've got wrong. If your hit rate is only 2/3, which is a good number in smaller micro caps, means 1/3 of them are wrong. So 1/3 of the time stocks are going down, if you double down, you're going to get extremely lopsided onto a losing position. And I always say, if you're losing, you've got to decide three outcomes. You either sell it, you hold it, or you buy more. And I rarely buy any more because I know I'm wrong a third of the time.
The very wise words again, Paul. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I tried to write an article about this the other day about averaging down, because actually some of my best investments have been ones where I have averaged down. But it's where I think averaging down because the share price has fallen and trying to chase a lower break-even price, that nearly always goes wrong. Mm. But I think where you've researched it in depth and you're absolutely sure that you're right with your thesis, then adding to the position, I think not immediately after a profit warning. Again, that's a knee-jerk reaction. You often see buyers steam in when there's been a profit warning. And it all depends on the quality of the company, doesn't it? Mm. You know, averaging down on a really good quality oversold company is one of the best investing strategies. But as you say, just chasing your losses down on something you've fundamentally got wrong is just the worst. I've heard some disastrous stories of people who've done that.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and I think the key sort of like or distinguishing trait in our situation is the company got a decent balance sheet? Because
even
if the investment thesis is down, but it needs to raise money and the shares are down, it's going to be a bad result for you either way.
It is. I mean, some of the discounted placings we've seen over the last couple of years are just horrendous, aren't
they? It's been brutal. Oh. Now, just turning tack, what about, I know it's working before, sort of Sosandar, which is one of those sort of like, it's an online ladies fashion business, largely for 20-30% plus. And I guess the key question here, they seem to be doing terrifically, knocking the ball out of the park in like for likes and all this sort of stuff, is the increasing competition, one from the Chinese, because obviously, you know, they've been moving in and going direct to consumer, but also you've had a renaissance, amazingly enough, and I can't believe I'm saying this, in the likes of M&S. I mean, ladies wearing M&S. I mean, what? I've never even heard of
it. It's great to see, isn't it? They finally turned it around. So, it's wonderful.
So how do you see sort of Sosandar going forward then?
Well, I don't think the direct to consumer side is a threat at all, because that's right at the bottom end. And the Sosandar customer is an affluent customer, you know, who'll be shopping at, you know, the nicer brands. They wouldn't entertain buying direct from China, I don't think.
That's fast fashion, is it? That's sort of like your younger demographic.
Sosandar's not for fast fashion at all. It's sort of next and a bit above in terms of the customer. They've got very good repeat business, very loyal customer base at Sosandar. It's profitable now. The last update was Sosandar said that the growth rate had slowed to only about 10% in Q1, which I think for them, I think it's a March year end, so that's April, May, June. Now, that did disappoint some people, understandably, because the full year forecast is 36%. So it's going to be quite a big ask to get from 10% to 36% in the remaining 9 months. So I think the market understandably, lost some of its enthusiasm for Sosandar. So I'm not sort of saying Sosandar is a raging buy now. I'm saying, you know, it's doing all the right things and its long-term track record is now established. You know, it's a significant player in women's wear. The third-party deals are all going great. It's selling very well through Next and M&S, funnily enough, through their website. It's going into physical Sainsbury's stores imminently. They've just launched through an international partner on a low-risk way of doing it. So there's lots of stuff in the pipeline. And I think they've proven that they've got this niche brand that does resonate well with the customers. So I think just as a long-term thing for me, you know, I want to be holding Sosandar for 5 years plus, and I think we should do very well in that time frame. Unless they get the fashions wrong.
Yeah.
This is the big problem with the fashion sector, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's been a lot of M&A, hasn't there, in there? You've had Seraphine, which I know you benefited from, and you've had Mike Ashley's sort of Fraser always, you know, getting bits and pieces. You've had Boohoo looking at Revolution Beauty and all this sort of stuff. So there seems to be quite a lot of M&A actually for good quality.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it though is sort of picking over the wreckage, isn't it?
the sector, there is a bit really. Of that, yeah, okay.
I mean, God knows what Mike Ashley's strategy is. It's just bizarre, isn't it? But, I mean, he's you know, I can't see the Kamani family at Boohoo in particular having much time for him being on the shareholder register. So I wouldn't be surprised if they take it private. Yeah. But I don't think they'll be generous to outside shareholders because they're canny rag traders. So I'm just generally avoiding that sector. I think, again, my sector knowledge when I was in FD in the 90s, I think is now a lot of it is out of date. So
yeah, you can't hang your boots up. You can't have your gloves up yet there, Paul. You're an expert compared to me, that's for sure.
Well, I haven't really picked the winners in the sector. Although Sosandar's been all right, but Shoezone I missed, and you know, I've missed quite a lot of the winners, so I don't think I've really got an edge in that sector, so it's time to look at other sectors really.
Okay. What about Card Factory? Because I know you're quite, but that's knocked the ball out of the park. With its stores, and it's surprising really, because it's obviously been a beneficiary of Clinton Card's demise and when he went bust. But you've got that sort of secular tailwinds or the headwind as much as anything to all things online. How do you see sort of Card Factory? Because it's really growing strongly despite what you'd think more longer term.
Mm. It's doing tremendously well, actually. I mean, I have top sliced my position in Card Factory because I was raising money to buy more Plexus, but my enthusiasm for the share has not dimmed at all. And I do want to go back up to a full position size in Card Factory when I can, when funds are available. Now, one thing I would say is I looked at the stock report on Stockopedia earlier today, and they've got this little graph showing the trend of broker consensus earnings forecasts, and it's had two quite significant upward revisions, Card Factory has in recent months, and the forward PE I think now is 7.5 or something.
Yeah, it's less than 8. You're right.
It's very cheap. Yeah. And the bank debt is coming down quite rapidly. I looked at the last cash flow statement, really very impressive cash generation. The new management, Darcy something or other, seems to be doing very, very good common sense things in terms of broadening the product range into complementary items that you buy at the checkout. And I mystery shop it occasionally myself. And the prices are very, very keen. Mm. You know, you can buy a bag of balloons and some happy birthday sort of streamer things and a couple of quid each. It's
good value.
I think it's a brilliant business and very, very cheap. Now, the only downside on it is the biggest shareholder is dribbling shares into the market. Mm. They put out a number of holding in company announcements showing them dropping 1%, I think from 18, then to 17, then to 16, possibly to 15, I can't remember. But that, I think, is definitely quite obviously causing an overhang in the market. But when that clears, at some point, I don't know why they're selling. I don't know whether they want to sell all of them or just some. No idea. But I think that is presenting an opportunity. For you just wait for the overhang to clear and then the thing goes up. I mean, it's about £1.04 or £1.05 now. Yeah. I think it really should be worth £1.50 in due course if the current trends continue. So I think there's nice upside on that. And I think they're bringing in the dividend again, possibly next year. So medium term, I think Card Factory looks terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know Richard Crowe of Cockney Rebel from fame. He loves it, doesn't he? It's his biggest holding. So
it's his biggest holding. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm speaking to him in a month's time. So I'll be interested to pick his brain on how he sees that one. Now, what about, I know you've done a bit of sort of mystery shopping, XP Factory, the experiential sort of like leisure with Bloom Battle Bars and escape rooms. And escape rooms actually have benefited from sort of like the almost like strangely the work from home. Because I've had a lot of corporate bookings for team building at Christmas. So they seem to be doing pretty well. Could be a bit of an inflection point this year as well.
Yeah, I think I've got a significant, for me, size position in it. Yeah, I think it's very, very good. Management, I think Richard Harpham is superb. I've met him a couple of times and he showed me around the Oxford Street site, which I think he might have done for you and for Justin and a few other commentators. And, you know, the whole site the whole business just really runs off his kind of energy and enthusiasm, really. I think it's got a different feel to it to other businesses that I've visited, and it's very popular. The customers really enjoy the sort of slightly retro themed games, a lot of them. And I think the experiential leisure sector is definitely taking a chunk out of the business that kind of standard regular bars have. And that was the reason I decided to part company with Revolution Bars, which I only bought them around 5 or 6p, and I sold them at a small loss. for about 5p or 4.9p or something. It wasn't a huge position, but he's got too much debt. Mm. And I think some of my readers persuaded me out of that one, actually, funnily enough. I was sort of writing up the positives on it, and the readers said, well, hang on, haven't you thought about this, this and this? And they basically said that they feel the £18 million drawdown on the HSBC facility to buy Peach Pubs. Mm. The readers on Stockopedia see that as a sort of management buying a life raft, yeah. Really, in that the core late night bars side of it is just... And your problem is, if your like-for-likes are down 10%, when you're on a 75% gross margin, that 10% drop is ruinous for your bottom line.
Particularly when you've got cost inflation coming in as well.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, so I think Revolution Bars is a bit dicey, I think. I just don't want to take the risk.
Yeah,
I mean, look, somebody could come in and bid for it for 10 or 15p. I just don't know. But, you know, it's the debt that I don't generally want to be holding companies with debt right now, because the days of leniency and zombie companies when, you know, the interest cost was only 0% plus 1.5 margin or something, the banks were happy to let them just buy their time and trade their way out. Now that the interest is accruing, and some of these companies, you know, say Superdry, for example, you know, it's only got borrowings on 10, 12, 15%. Well, that compounds quite badly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And see, Superdry came back from trading today, didn't it?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
They're
down about 15%, I think.
Right.
45, 46p. I think that could go bust next year. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think it does seem as though the consumer is getting far more discriminating. It's got a certain budget that it's going to spend on, you know, it's leisure and it's retail, and the winners are going to be stronger and get through the sort of like the softer patch, whereas the weaker guys in a higher interest rate environment are going to really struggle, if not go bust.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing with Superdry, though, is that they did actually get the money in for that £35 million IP sale, which does actually in the Far East, and that does prove that the brand actually is worth something. Mm. So, you know, you can argue it both ways, but I wouldn't want to take the risk. I got clobbered with Jewels, where I stubbornly thought I knew best and it would recover, and it totally crapped out. So yeah. I think I'm just not going to get involved with any more struggling fashion businesses. It's such a low percentage of them actually to do turn themselves around. That's the thing.
Yeah, well, turnarounds are high risk, and you get make great returns on the back of them if you get them right, as unlike the shareholders do. But you know, if they go, most of the time they're high risk because they don't go right, and it's harder than you think.
That's all right. And there was something interesting in the paper about Hilco as well. You know, they do the sort of lender of last resort.
Yeah,
and it. Was saying how they basically lend at high interest rates to struggling retailers, so they've got their foot in the door for effectively taking over the business and buying all the stock for pennies in the pound when the thing goes bust, and they make money, you know, in two or three different ways.
Yeah.
So really, seeing Hilco as a second lender to Superdry is actually quite a red flag, I'd say.
Yeah, and Hilco haven't got a checkered reputation. I've seen a few of those haven't gone their way either. So it just shows you how difficult it is to change the psychology and perception of consumers. To
they're usually the big secured creditor.
Yes,
they call the shots in the administration and they make money out of the administration apparently.
Yeah, but but overall they can still lose. I've seen a few of them where they've even gone through pre-pack deals. But anyway, regardless, what about SCS, the sofa guys? Because they were a pandemic winner. They still seem to be gaining market share, and they've got this cash mountain, which is just enormous on their balance sheet.
Yeah, it's about the same as the market cap. And some people say, oh, it's not really their money, but it continuously rotates. So it'll always be there. And if you look at DFS, they've stripped every penny of that cash out and they've maxed out their overdraft as well. So you can extract that cash. But what's interesting is I would have thought private equity would be all over this, but the private equity guys don't seem to be interested in value type plays, do they? Mm. They're only going for these structural growth, particularly software and healthcare type businesses. So SCS just sits there languishing. But yeah, I think risk reward on it's very good. I did dip my toe in recently with a small purchase on SCS. And I think as funds become available, I'll buy more. I think the yield is about 8.5% on SCS now.
Yeah.
And they've been doing buybacks, I think, as well, which enhances your EPS and your DPS. probably not the best management out there. I think DFS is a much, much better business, but it's got diabolical finances and balance sheet, whereas SCS, I think SCS is having a bad-ish year, but it's on a PE of about 10 in a fairly suppressed consumer spending environment. So the way I look at that is that in more normal trading, you know, economic circumstances in a year or two, SCS could, you know, could be a 50% to 100% gainer from the current level, and you've got absolutely no solvency worries, and somebody might well come and bid for it as well for the cash pile. So yeah, I think risk reward on SCS is pretty good, actually.
You may raise a good point on private equity in terms of what they're looking to buy, and the reason is they tend to go for this, you know, secular growers in tech or healthcare with high gross margins, and where their expertise is basically bundling a bunch of those similar businesses together, stripping out all the overheads on a high gross margin, high unit economic type business. Yeah. And therefore it just drops straight down to the bottom lines, and then they relist it or sell it as a bigger business on a higher multiple. It's that buy and build, and then they have, and that's the easiest way to raise money, particularly in a higher interest rate environment, from investors. But so if you're looking for private equity to buy companies, then it's technology, software and healthcare.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And that's kind of your sweet spot as well, isn't it?
So
you know, I'm listening much more closely to what you, some of the stocks you cover, because they could well be bid targets. Some of them.
Oh, some of them could be bid targets, but yeah, I have my travails. I get blown up many a time. Don't worry. So don't follow what my portfolio is doing. That's for sure. Sanderson Designs, which I think does is sort of like a, it does sort of wallpaper and decorative designs for houses, improvements and this sort of stuff. How do you see this one playing out?
I like this one. I bought quite recently on a update. Everybody keeps expecting it to warn on profits because it's sort of, you know, middle to high end fashion orientated fabrics and wallpaper. And
a bit like Laura Ashley sort of like revisited.
Yeah, they've got five or six different brands. I tell you, there's a similar one, a smaller one called Colfax as well, which is quite obscure. That's in a similar type of vein. Sanderson Design Group, but it keeps putting out reassuring inline trading updates, and Sanderson does. And what it's basically been saying is that there has been a slowdown in the wallpaper and fabrics division, but the licensing division is putting in a barnstorming performance, and licensing revenues are normally valued on quite a high multiple. Although actually, as some of the reader comments pointed out, the licensing deals with Sanderson tend to be quite short term. So quite a few of them are, for example, for a one or two seasons range of clothes with Next, or you know, that sort of thing. H&M, I think, did, and of course it's got this design archive, massive historic design archive. It owns all the Morrison Co. designs, the William Morris designs, and it's got some, I think at some point somebody might well buy it for that back catalogue, which does seem to have, I don't know the ins and outs of how design trademarks work, but it does seem to have watertight intellectual property over these designs. And there's been a deal with Disney recently, which I would imagine could be quite lucrative. And the CEO, Lisa Montague, is a force of nature. I think she's brilliant. I interviewed her a while ago, and she's really done a lot of very good commercial stuff at Sanderson, which, and the balance sheet's absolutely bulletproof, got loads of cash. Yeah. I think, you know, you've got to accept that. I think for me, I like to have a basket of things like that. And I know the in situation like we've got now, one, maybe two of them will warn on profits. You know, you can't avoid it. I wish I knew.
I'd agree,
But actually, the interesting thing is, on my top 20 watch list for this year, where I flagged up my sort of value GARP type picks for the year, that's actually up 6% year to date. So that's outperformed AIM by 18%, which I'm very pleased with. But that's within that list, there've been, I think, at least two profit warnings. So it's quite interesting, isn't it? In that within a diversified portfolio of 20 shares, you can absorb a few profit warnings.
Well, my portfolio this year is about that 6% up, but I've had about three profit warnings. So yeah, you can
have
you can absorb it, but
you can absorb them. And and if you have one takeover bid, you know, that'll mop up at least one profit warning. So what were your three profit warnings then, Paul, out of interest?
One is an office. It is a profit warning. It's a census which does software for large scale buildings for work from home sort of stuff. Anyway, that's been a nightmare share for me. I've had another one. No, I know there's that one, and then I've had Inspiration Healthcare had a profit warning last week, small one last week. So I'm hoping to speak to the CEO, and then I unfortunately got absolutely taken to the woodshed last. Luckily, it was a smaller position, Sondrel.
Sorry to hear that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was basically. It was only 60% down on the day, so it wasn't a big hit, you know.
I had a look at that one last week. I think it's bloody awful. I have to say.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, just to let you know, I've had a good look at it, and I'm going to hold it. And the reason why I'm holding it because the investment thesis is still there as long as they can get through the short term cash problem which they've got. They should be fine for this year, because one thing, you know, if you look through the balance sheet and the cash flow statement, they've got a working capital unwind from last year because they had a large tier one OEM EV manufacturer who hadn't paid them £4 million, which came in the first half.
I noticed receivables were peculiarly high, but they've got weird and large creditors.
Yeah,
and that is
SaaS software they've bought. Yeah. Just the way they do it, and that's over 3 years. So essentially, what they've got is their SaaS software is about £200,000-£300,000 of outflow is a commitment each month, and they've got a similar amount on their salaries. And if you put it all in, they need to hit their engineering division needs to hit about £15 million a turnover. They're currently on 13, need to hit £15 million a turnover, because it's much higher margin to basically be cash flow break even. So the big problem which they've got is, are these three delayed contracts, are they synonymous with it's the industry stopped? Has they basically not going to get any more orders? And if that's the case, then you know, they're going to really, really struggle in 2024. Or is the US, which is buoyant, going to be able to get them out of the pain point, and they can win contracts and deliver the £15 million plus for next year?
I've got to ask you, Paul, if you didn't hold it already, would you buy?
No, because I'm holding it now. I'm not doubling down. That's for sure. The thing is such that. What they've got, their customers are things like Tesla and Apple and lots of electronics manufacturers, and it's a two-speed industry. The US is absolutely flying, but Europe and Israel is really struggling. And because it's the two-speed situation, is the US going to slow down like Europe in the ASIC chip design, digital chip design, or alternatively, is the US going to carry on and continue going gangbuster, and they're going to get through it? And hey, I don't know. There is an argument you could say you want to just get rid of it just for the sake of it. But there is a large seller actually at the moment, which is why it went down so much. Yeah. And therefore it's sort of like pretty low. But
this is also, I think, a structural problem with recent IPOs, in that because of the way brokers float things, they usually just place large blocks of stock with a 10 or 12 institutions, usually the same names, and so there's no aftermarket liquidity, is there? Particularly if everything goes wrong, you know, everyone's just left high and dry. So
when you had one institutional shareholder and they haven't announced who it is, selling 5 million shares, it goes down by 60%, which is what happened. But the thing is such that, you know, you and I have been through these kind of things, and it comes down to emotional stability. You know you're going to be wrong. You just don't know which socks you're going to get wrong.
Yes.
And at the moment, this is what I've got badly wrong. It's cost me a lot, but mentally I can get through it. Financially, I can get through it. And on that basis, then you learn it. And if you look at it on a positively basis, if they do come through, then it will do well next year as a potential upside. If it goes south, then you know, it's a very small position now compared to what it was. So it isn't going to do. But more importantly, it gives you as an investor hunger, and it gives you a reality check that if you've been through a good patch, you know, you just wait until you get smacked in the face, as Mike Tyson says, you know, because that's what it will happen. It's just as a matter of when. And if it gives you that more hunger and more passion and desire to, you know, look for other opportunities and to improve learn from it. That's it. It's a learning game, isn't it? Continuous
it
improvement.
Is. And do you find when you've gone through a really good patch, like a lot of us did in 2020 and 2021, you find that you, without realizing it, you greatly lower your quality.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. Selection. You throw the dice. Yeah.
And you can end up just punting on things that in normal circumstances you wouldn't touch. Yeah. I definitely find I do that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's natural. It's human nature, isn't it? And you've got to pinch yourself. But I think the big picture is if you go through a lucky patch, and I've, you know, been through some lucky patches at the time when you have 3, 4, 5, you do really well in a couple of years, this sort of stuff, and your portfolio roars. Then equally, you can, because we both carry a lot of idiosyncratic risk, you can have a similar period of 1 or 2 or 3 years when actually you do a lot worse than the actual market and you've got to get through it. But overall, the direction of travel is still up sort of mid teens, which is a great overall return. But you've got to go through that fluctuation to get to the end point.
Yeah, and I think also it's very easy to start doubting yourself and, you know, saying, look, am I actually any good at this? Maybe I'm just no good at it. But I think the way to respond to that, certainly what I've done this year, following on from an awful year last year, is just to work harder and just to raise that. So those selection criteria to stock picking business is really a game of elimination, isn't it? You're looking at hundreds and hundreds of opportunities. Yeah. And I find I do best when I eliminate nearly all of them. Mm. And I literally just distill it down to a handful of key stocks where I think I've genuinely found something that's highly advantageous to me, and that then lays the groundwork for a big recovery, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And it, you know, it's risk management and also risk and reward, because as you talked about with Plexus, is looking at the downside as well as the upside. The upside's enormous, but if it goes wrong, then you're going to be able to walk away. It isn't going to change your quality of life or your family's quality of life. You know,
that's right.
It's going to mentally wise, it's going to dent you. It's going to dent your confidence. But you can. It isn't a sort of like an all or nothing. You never want one stock to break you, basically.
No, and I think because I've suffered catastrophic losses on the spread bet accounts in 2008 and again actually in 2022, I think I'm kind of hardened to risk and to losses. If my ungeared portfolio has dropped 20 or 25%, I just kind of think, well let's just get it back, you know. It'll take a couple of years to get it back, get on with it, you know. Whereas I know a lot of friends, you know, particularly the younger investors who maybe have not been doing that long, who are utterly distraught, you know, almost quite seriously, some of them almost having breakdowns and wondering whether they should tell their wife that they've messed up and all this sort of thing. And you know, it's very worrying. That's why I just think, you know, it's just best for everyone not to use gearing. Just an accident. It's an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah, no, I move well away from derivatives. As Warren Buffett says, they're weapons of mass destruction, wealth destruction, I think maybe he calls
them. Tell me about it.
But there's another one. It's like, you know, if you're a sort of an investor and you get, you know, the classic IFA question when they come to an investor is, what's your risk tolerance? And they have all this sort of catalogue. But frankly, you can bin that, because the only thing that tells you what your real risk tolerance is when you blow through it and then it's real painful. And that's when you really know your risk tolerance. And I've been through it. And as you blow through it, your risk tolerance, you get hardened to it over that period. Because you, I mean, let's be clear about it. You know, I've still got a smile on my face, and Sondrel lost, you know, was 60% yes. decrease on last week. Not that I didn't sleep well. I haven't slept well since, but I mean, you've got to basically get through it, haven't you? Simple as that.
Yeah, it's part of the process.
Yeah.
You know, we all have to accept profit warnings, and that's just the way it goes sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, well done for coping with it so well, Paul.
I'll go and have another Valium tablet.
Well, actually, I'm feeling quite chilled out today because I had a can of drink that, oh, I don't know what I've done with it, containing CBD, which...
Oh, well done, okay.
Yeah, I've never had it before, and I thought, well, should I be having this just before doing an interview with Paul?
I've never even heard of a can. You could buy cans with cannabis in it.
It's meant to chill you out, isn't it?
Exactly. Did you get it from Holland or something?
No, just the local Sainsbury's.
Really? Wow.
Part of the meal deal as well. So, yeah,
okay, right. I'll have to go. I've nipped down a local supermarket then. Now, we're just on the chip designers, CML Microsystems, which doesn't do the low nanometer digital chips that Sondrel does. It does a sort of like the RF and the wideband, more for sort of industrial applications, I think, in Internet of Things and 5G. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it seems to be doing pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, you just asked me to flag up some interesting stocks that I'd reviewed in the last 3 months on the small cap value reports. And this one came up where... it's not one I hold personally, but I do think it's interesting because it's dropped by about a quarter in the last few months. But actually, the fundamentals reported have been good. Yeah. It's an interesting special situation where it's got surplus cash and surplus freehold property. It's developing the surplus land. It's like a business park that it owns. It's developed. It's finally, after years of waiting, got planning permission. So the market knows about that. That's all in the price. But I just thought you've got a nice thing here where you've got downside protection with the cash and the property, which supports about half the market cap. Yeah. And you seem to have a nice little business that's also actually trading rather well. And when you adjust out the surplus assets, you know, the PE ratio is quite cheap. So just it might be one that people might like to have a look at. I don't have a particularly strong view on it. And I've got no idea what it does. I don't understand the products at all.
Well, it's obviously got some IP there. Now,
it's been around a while. I think it's quite a nice little company, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one sector that you've done pretty well on is defence. You've got Cohort with a huge order backlog. I think you've interviewed the CEO there. And MS International, which is a similar large. It's got a number of divisions, but its defence is the biggest with a big order book. And it's got this anti-drone type weapon, which is developed. So do you want to take us through your latest thoughts on both of those? Because they must have huge visibility, given the war in Ukraine still ongoing, I guess.
Yeah, well, that was really what drew me to both of them, actually. I mean, I've been aware of both Cohort and MS International for years. They've been around for quite a while. But I think they're both particularly attractive at the moment because they've both received very large orders in some cases for new products. And so you've got these multi-year order backlogs that give you, as you said, tremendous visibility. Cohort, I think, is on a forward PE of only about 13.
Historically,
it's always been rated a lot higher. So it's had a de-rating, and yet the fundamentals are good. And the order book keeps growing. And I think they've had 6 or 7 large contract win announcements this year. So I think this is a bit of a coiled spring for a re-rating. I would expect Cohort as the next bull market emerges in small caps, which will happen, we just don't know when. I think you could probably look at this re-rating up to a PE of 17 or 18, and you get a nice, you know, dividend in the meantime. Management struck me as very capable. I interviewed the CEO, Andy Thomas. I just do CEO interviews for fun, really, for interesting companies. I don't charge for them. I just enjoy doing them. And it helps me understand the business model. And I think he gave a very good account for what they're doing at Cohort. So, yeah, I think it's a nice quality company on a value share rating. So have a look at that one, CHRT. Now, MS International was slightly different. They've just announced, actually, on Friday, a big contract win, I think, from the US Navy. Mm. Very unusual for British companies to be able to sell products to the US. And it's for large caliber guns, I think, for warships, destroyers or something. And as you know, there are large numbers of destroyers, you know, hundreds or dozens of them in large naval fleets. And one thing I didn't understand, though, it announced a maintenance and support contract win, but it hasn't actually supplied the guns yet. So it seems to have been announced the other way around, which people who know the company better than me are speculating means that the actual big contract to buy the guns must be in the bag, because you wouldn't sign a support deal for it. So that's a bit peculiar. So I don't understand that bit. But now the other angle on this is that the director's got, I think, four different divisions MS International has. Mm. Both sort of all unrelated and quite weird that they're in a group, but they're all good, high margin niche businesses. And the guys who run MS International have been running it literally forever, you know, decades they've worked there, and they're all getting on a bit now. And so I think it's one of those situations where it's probably going to be maximized for sale value when they want to retire. Probably in the not too distant future. So, and I've done very well on situations like that in the past. Avesco was one where precisely Yeah, and that we got more than 5 or 6 bagger out of it. And the value was obvious. It was just sitting there on a plate, but nobody was interested. But the owner wanted to sell it so he could retire, the founder, CEO. And so he closed down the loss-making bits. Mm. Or sold them off, and suddenly you had this fabulously profitable business, and he got a real premium bid for it as well. So I think you could have something similar happen at MS International. Mm. Very, very illiquid, very tightly held.
Yeah, how do you buy shares?
A nice business.
How do you buy shares in a liquid stock like? Because I've bought shares of this about 10, 15 years ago, and I struggled putting about 20 grand in. It was like.
Yeah, oh yeah, you'd have to break that up probably into 4 purchases.
It was amazing.
Yeah, but you see, I've got one of these internet dealing accounts now where I'm only paying £5.95 for each trade. Okay. So there's no problem with breaking it up into 4 or 5 grand parcels. You just nibble away, wait for it to go red one day, that means somebody's selling, and you know, and it'll quote you a spread of sort of £7.10 at £7.70.
Yeah.
Okay. But actually, you put in a dummy trade and you can probably buy it £7.20.
Yeah,
you know, so I don't know what the market makers are doing with these prices they quote. Are ridiculous, because it deters people from even bothering to look.
Yeah, you know, I give up if I can't get a reasonable chunk easily. Yes. I just say, okay, it's too small for me. I can't get the liquidity.
Yeah.
I'm moving on. I
tend to be more patient. I mean, I think my position sizes are a lot smaller than yours these days. But you know, I'll happily just nibble away at it. Over maybe a few weeks and months,
a few beers, a few cannabinoid tinnies.
Yeah, and you can build up positions gradually. But the trouble is, then if something goes wrong, you can't get out.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it just annoys the hell out of me is such that to build up a big position, I'd be there for like 4 weeks or a month or 2 months or something like that every single day, and I just haven't got the time or the patience to do it. And
fair
I just
enough.
Think. Forget
yeah,
it. You know, I've just got to move on. If there's no liquidity in it, it just isn't for
me. Or you can just ring the house broker and say, put me down on your list. An institution wants to sell some, give me a call.
Yeah.
I've done that before.
Yeah, no, true, true. Anyway, yeah, no, I think they're both very good. And the other thing about MS International, hasn't it? It's got that really quite unique anti-drone gun as well that seems to be.
Yes, I mean, which is good.
Well, given the amount of drones flying around Ukraine and Russia at the moment, you see how it strategically it's changed the whole sort of like land battle defense and the naval defense.
Yeah.
So if you've got something which does that and can shoot these things out the sky, then it's going to sell a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think MS International has announced, again, similar to Cohort, has announced some large contract wins in the last 6 months. That was actually the catalyst for me buying into it, actually.
Yeah, I think you've chosen both. Well, I mean, I haven't got any defence stocks, but yeah, I think both of them are top draw. Love to buy them. Okay, so Zotefoams, industrials, which it does a sort of like... I think it's sort of driven by sort of secular growth for sort of HVAC and global warming and all this sort of stuff. But it does sort of foams and insulation, doesn't it, for sort of like high value items.
Yeah, it's specialist high performance foams where it claims world leadership in terms of technology and know-how.
Yeah.
And I think that's backed up by the fact that it makes pretty good margins. The biggest product is trainer specialist trainer soles for Nike, and
Right, okay.
Nike, yeah, and I think that's about 40% of its business and pretty good margin. That Nike's just renewed an exclusivity agreement with them, I think, for another 5 or 6 years, so that's good.
Those are the Air Jordans you're wearing at the moment.
I don't know which products they are, but it's staggering the money people will pay for
Only
for these
$300
trainers.
for an Air Jordan, so it's cheaper, half
God,
the price.
amazing, isn't it? Yeah, and they do. They're benefiting as well from the turnaround of the aviation sector. So
Yes.
that got clobbered during the pandemic, obviously, but now that's building back up again. I think the Zotefoam foam supplies that, and then so they've got some nice sector tailwinds. Same with automotive recovery there, as the semiconductor chip shortage turns around, it means production's rising. I was very impressed with the way management handled the energy crisis at Zotefoams. They were able to pass on all the additional costs to clients. I mean, they made it look easy. I'm sure it wasn't easy but the fact that they're able to pass on those costs, whereas you look at, say, for example, a company like McBride or other consumer manufacturers, you know, they got absolutely clobbered because the supermarkets wouldn't accept any price rises, or they were delayed. Whereas Zotefoams, they got they didn't skip a beat. And so I think actually with both the pandemic and then more recently with the energy crisis and higher inflation, we're really getting some fabulous information on all these companies about the strengths and weaknesses of their business models, you know. And companies that have got through these multiple crises, you know, intact and with great skill and so on, and really, it's telling us those are the ones to be investing in for the future, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think it's a really good point. You've got such a sort of like it's a case study, isn't it? If you've got a business that comes out of the all the knocks we've had the last 3 years, still maintaining its growth and margins, then it tells you it's got real economic resilience, and
It does,
it's a master of its own destiny rather than being sort of buffeted by it just totally external factor. I would say with Zotefoams, it's about 170 odd, 180 odd million market cap business. I would not be surprised if an industrial trade buyer is looking to pick these up, given the quality of the asset.
yeah, I agree. And it's also got the cherry on top, if you like, is this resource with a Z, which is their fully recyclable drinks carton that's in development. They're spending about £2 million a year on developing that. So you could arguably add that onto profits and say, well, that's a discretionary, a separate project that if it doesn't work, we'll just drop away and profits will go up. If it does work, it could, you know, it could be
Huge.
a big seller. So I like to have something a bit blue sky thrown in for free.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And interestingly, going back to your other point, so Sandar Management on the Q&A I did with them a little while ago, they said we've never known normal. They started the business, I think, in 2017 or 2018, and it's been just one massive crisis after another ever since. But and they've grown and they've taken market share and they've moved into profits. Well, that tells you once things are more normal, that business is probably going to fly.
That's a good, absolutely really good point. It gives you that resilience, and gives you more certainty as an investor if we can get through the toughest times. Another one which is sort of like really upskilling actually is Volex, which is a large company, Nat Rothschild sort of baby, and they've been on a buy and build strategy, but now they do sort of cabling and all this sort of stuff. But it really started moving to healthcare with MRI scanners into data centers, and I think they've even got a contract now with Tesla in their in their
Yeah, they've had
business.
all of those for a while, actually, Paul. Yeah, but it's the strategy. I mean, Nat Rothschild has worked wonders at Volex, I think. He really has, and he owns 25% of it. Although I think his shareholding in Volex is probably worth less than his super yacht, which apparently is moored off Corfu or something half the time. So you would think, well, maybe Volex is just a plaything for him. But it seems to me he's really committed to it, and you know, wants to, if you like, prove that he can run and build a great business, I think. So I don't know, I've never spoken to him, but he sounds really upbeat on the webinars, and they're doing acquisitive growth. So yes. It's a sort of buy and build type thing, really. And they don't seem to have put a foot wrong. They've just announced and just completed another big acquisition in Turkey.
Yeah.
That's at least two fairly chunky acquisitions in Turkey, which is obviously benefiting from reshoring because it's got a global footprint, Volex has now. And each deal they do, you can see exactly why they've done it. You know, it's complementary markets, complementary products. Excuse me, buying synergies. I like acquisitive groups, actually. You know, conventionally, we would often turn our, a lot of us would turn our nose up at acquisitive groups because so many of them went wrong and they had to write off the goodwill and all the rest of it. But I think actually now I'm changing my mind. Where they're disciplined buyers of businesses in the same sector that they know inside out, they know exactly what they're buying it at the right price, I think it can create a lot of value.
Yeah.
And in particular, retirement sales. Mm. We've seen that from SDI, from Judges Scientific, and I think Volex now is also picking up on companies where the owners want to retire. I think Tikkurat Murat was one like that. So yeah, I think it's basically a successful buy and build group that's really well managed, and it's on a value share rating of a PE of about 12 or 13.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see it coming through on the EBIT margins. It's over 10% now. So
it's making good margins.
That just shows you that there's good IP there, no doubt about it. And you're right, in terms of if you've got a blueprint for your integration, having done acquisitions, it's just really keep turning the wheel. You know,
hit
squad come in, they know what the price they've paid, they know what the synergies they need to do.
Exactly. And
it isn't learning, going up the learning curve. You've just basically you know what you're going to deliver, and that's it. You know, you deliver.
Yeah, I think the acquisitive groups that go wrong is either way you've got just delusional idiots running the company who think they're great deal makers but aren't, or it's where they buy something that they're diversifying into a sector that they don't know anything about. That's where the really big clangers seem to happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or if they buy something that's fashionable, you know, something that says it's got, does AI or something, and they pay some insane ratio of it and they borrow the money for it. Those are the type of deals that go wrong. But I think
any company which says an adjacent market, then you've got to basically, it's a red flag, isn't it? So be warned.
Good point.
Another one which is a fairly successful buy and build is Reddle, the chain boys. And they really seem to be sort of like doing well. I mean, you know, in terms of the quality and the margins. What's your latest view on these guys?
Very positive. Again, I should declare I own shares in Volex and Reynolds. They're sort of long-term core holdings of mine. Reynolds, very, very good turnaround. The guy running it's excellent. I think it was a slow turnaround that took years and years, but it's worked. And he's now really on the front foot, buying complementary businesses. I think they bought one in Spain. They've just done a tiny acquisition in Australia. Again, it's industrial chains and torque transmission couplings and gearboxes and things. So they really know their sector inside out. And they're just bolting on good businesses, often, again, retirement sales. They pay a low EBITDA multiple for them. They know the markets. And it's just rinse and repeat, really. And the extra benefit of what they're doing at Reynolds is that each acquisition helps dilute the pension problem.
Yes.
So it's a bit like what Norcross are doing. They're just gradually, you know, slowly over time, the pension becomes less of an issue. And they've managed to fully support it for many, many years without doing any equity dilution.
Yeah.
And now it's self-funding acquisitions as well. So, I think Reynolds, for a nice, patient, long-term buy and hold, I think will do well on that.
Yeah.
Well, and again, somebody will probably come along and buy it.
Yeah, I mean, with a PE of less than 6, then absolutely. Yeah,
I mean, that's because of the pension deficit.
Yeah,
that's
exactly,
swallowing
yeah,
up about yeah. 5 million a year, which obviously doesn't go through earnings, does it?
Yeah.
So, even allowing for that, it's too cheap, I think.
Yeah. Well, another turnaround, Restore, which I think you've had a good look at. What's the sort of latest on this? Because they've had a profit warning, haven't they? Which is, I mean, basically what they do is sort of archive old companies and NHS and healthcare and all records, put it into big warehouses for long term, look after it, and so they can bring it back or they scan it. And this sort of, first of all, what was behind the profit warning? And then secondly, how are they going to sort of resolve it?
Well, actually, the core business is doing okay. The problem seemed to emerge at It tried to sort of move up the value chain and buy a load of complementary businesses, IT related, and that doesn't really seem to work, basically. And the CEO who was behind that strategy had to walk the plank. And anyway, I mean, it was previously a real sort of go-go share, you know, a growth company that was going up and up and up. Everyone thought it was great, but it's absolutely tanked in, so it came up on one of my filters as just one of the biggest fallers. So I thought, right, well, I'll add that to my watch list. And when it next updates us, I'll have a look at it and put it up on Stockopedia by before the 8 a.m. opening bell, if it shows any signs of life. So anyway, it did. The most recent update, I forget when it was, maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks ago or something, basically said that things are not getting any worse. It said we're reaffirming guidance that we gave you a couple of months ago, which wasn't that much reduced from the previous forecast. And the main issue I was worried about was debt. Anyway, they gave updated numbers on debt that showed that it was reducing, that it was under control, the covenants were not going to be breached. So I looked at this and I thought, do you know what? This thing's oversold. We're going to get a bounce out of this. Yeah. And the shares were £1.25. So as you know, I never give recommendations to the readers, but I did say, look, have a look at this, as I think the conditions are now set for a bounce, because it's not getting any worse. It's very, very cheap and debt isn't a problem. So I think this is going to bounce, and I might buy some myself, which I did. I waited to see what happened in the first hour of trading or so, and it did actually drop a little bit further, but I couldn't buy any. There was no liquidity. But anyway, I managed to pick up a few, not a lot, of Restore at around, I think, between 125 and 130.
Yeah.
And I said, I think it's worth about £1.72.
All right, you're pretty good then.
Sounds very precise, but that was just working out, you know, a modest, lowish PE on the revised guidance and taking off a bit for the debt. And I said, look, I think this thing's 30, 40% too cheap. Anyway, it played out perfectly. Over about a 2-week period, it rebounded to £1.70. Yeah. So we got, I think one or two of the readers bought some as well. So we got a nice 30 or 40% quick profit out of that. And well, I think that's what so you've got several opportunities at the moment. One is loads of takeover bids coming through. The second one, I think, is being quite nipping in and out of these bounce type situations where things are oversold and you get an up, so you're up at 7, you're looking, reading quickly through all the updates, and every now and again I'm finding one where I'm thinking, oh, that's overdue a bounce, and sure enough, you know, we're making some quite good money on some of these things. So maybe we're all just turning into traders.
I mean, it's quite an interesting sort of like observation, because, you know, to make profits you've done really well this year. Not only have you had a few sort of takeovers, but you've had a shorter than usual time horizon where you've traded some in and out some quite good shares. I think there's likes of what was the one which had that real problem with its contracts? I can't remember the technology. Wandisco.
Wandisco. Yeah, that was horrific. Well, I got all my money back on that.
Exactly. Yes, you traded it well, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, when it came back from trading, it dropped from £9.50 to 50p. So I increased my position size by 35 times.
Yes.
So, I mean, talk about averaging down.
Yeah. On a special situation.
Special situation. I think it'll go to a quid, and it did.
Yeah.
So I got all my money back from, and the key thing was it was fully funded because it had done a placing. So you knew you didn't have to worry about cash for a few months. And I only wanted to be in it a few days, really, or a few weeks. And that one worked. Tiny build I did very well on. And an institution dropped the price 80% on a profit warning, bottomed out at about 5p.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't get them at that level, but I think I bought at an average of 7.5p. And it rose the next week to 13p. So I do think these bounces, if you pick them carefully and you really do your homework, I think there's nice opportunities right now.
Yeah. Well, as I say, it's more short-term risk and reward, and you need real skill to be able to do that. I can't play in that game. It's just it's too tough.
No, that's fair enough. And I would say as well, Paul, it's not either or. I mean, I've got most of my portfolio is for medium to long-term positions, but I, you know, like to have maybe 10 or 20% of it and doing some of these nip in and out type jobs. And ultimately, it doesn't matter how we make money, does it?
I'm not proud.
As my mentor says to me, Paul, just do more of whatever works for you. And so I think, you know, let's be flexible and adapt to market conditions.
Who's your mentor, by the way?
Oh, he remains anonymous.
Oh, does he? You've got one. Oh, I'm impressed.
Yeah, no, he's a great guy. He's supported me, you know, with great wisdom and emotional support and everything over about 25 years. So he's a fantastic friend. So yeah, I'm very lucky.
He doesn't live in Omaha, does he, with Mr. Buffett?
No, sadly not.
He's not that guy. Now, another area that you've done really well out, and this is a sort of like, I suppose, jumping on the coattails of it, is, well, it's gaming realms, because you did really well out of best of the best, and this one is sort of like software for sort of like low value game. It's more Bingo Slingo, I think it does
yeah,
for a
Slingo.
Lot of titles. Do you want to take us through this one, because you know, you did really well out of, you know, BOTB.
Well, I mean, people are going to be getting sick of this, aren't they? They're going to think, oh, Paul thinks he's so clever and he's good at everything.
But if you've made good money in one area and you know the onions in this area, why do you run away from it when you can see a similar opportunity? That's all I would say. That's sort of a broader point. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, on Gaming Realms, I was late to the party. I didn't spot it until quite recently, so I'm only slightly up on that one, GMR. Yeah. It's somebody flagged up to me that the 2022 results were really, really strong, and for some reason, I don't know why, probably just too busy on other things, it slipped through the net and I didn't cover it in the small cap value report. So belatedly, I had a look at them at a month or 6 weeks ago and I thought, gosh, this is really good. It's gaming software for Slingo is the main one.
Yeah.
It's this strange combination of a slot machine and Bingo above, sort of integrated, and it is really, really popular. It's like, for example, on television the other day, there was a gaming company, I think it was Red24 or something like that, who had a TV ad on, and they mentioned Slingo within it and had a screenshot of it. So, and Gaming Realms is behind the software, and I think it hosts the software as well on its own servers. And then online casinos sort of link into it and pay a royalty based on, you know, the amount of customers who play it, and it seems to be just going from strength to strength. Yeah. So I would say to people, have a look at the figures for Gaming Realms, and the forecasts look eminently achievable, and it's only on a forward PE of about 14 or 15 times, which is very cheap for a company that's generating this amount of organic growth, and it's selling this product globally, you know, and a lot of quite big US gaming groups are licensing it. So I think it looks really good. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the cash generation's enormous in these gaming companies. So I'm with you.
And I think, I'll tell you what I've just remembered what else it was with that. There was some substantial direct buying, well into six figures. From I think it's the non-exec who was the founder of Sportingbet.
Yeah, okay.
And he's buying up, you know, six-figure tranches of Gaming Realms shares. So he knows his stuff and he's got lots of money. So I think, you know, that seems a good person to follow.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Another one in the sort of the gaming sector, Rank Group, which does it's got the physical sort of Grosvenor casinos in the UK. I think it's got about 45% of the casino market in the UK, and then it's got the Mecca Bingos, which is more lower value. So it seems to be covering all bases. What's your sort of latest on this one?
Well, I know very little about it actually, but I thought I'd include one of Graham's stocks in this. Graham, my colleague at Stockopedia, he covered it fairly recently and said it doesn't look an obviously bargain type share, but it's reporting good progress on cost stabilization and reductions.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's got a very big share of the casino market. I think it's Grosvenor Casinos, its brand.
It is Grosvenor, yeah.
Yeah, which are nice, you know, nicely invested, pleasant sort of places to go if you go to casino. I mean, I don't go to. I used to be mad on casinos when I was in my 20s, and then I tell you, and I was always losing. And you know, you have a couple of big wins, don't you, that get you excited. But it was Evel Knievel, funnily enough, who put me off it once. When I lived in London for a little while, and I invited him out to a casino. I said, "Why don't you come with us? Me and a couple of others go."
Okay, I was going to say it wasn't the guy on his motorbike. This was the chap.
Evel Knievel. Yeah,
somebody called
Simon Corkwell. I said to him, "Would you like to just join us just for a meal and play a bit of roulette and everything at the casino?" And he looked at me and said, "Why on earth would I want to go to a casino?" He said, "The odds are against you, Paul. What the hell are you doing throwing money?" And I thought, bloody hell. That was like an epiphany. I thought, God, he's right.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever stepped in a casino since. It's mindless, yeah. isn't it? Just yeah. throwing money away.
Yeah. Albeit, if you've got casino licenses, there you just can't get them. So it isn't as though they're going to be putting new casinos, you know, sort of like around the UK, because it's just impossible.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. You know, no. So I mean, rank. Yes. I mean, obviously, rather than waste my money in a casino, I think it obviously makes more sense to own one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, they're saying that the high rollers are not coming to London so much, apparently.
Yeah.
So Graham, basically, I don't really want to speak for Graham, but I agree with what he wrote about it, which is that this looks nicely set up now for a good recovery as just consumer discretionary spend, you know, may improve over the next few years.
Yeah, I get my highs and lows from the stock market. I can't be doing with the sort of like going on blackjack, that's for sure.
No, me neither. Well, with the stock market, we found the ultimate ultimate form of posh gambling, my friends.
It is, yeah, exactly.
Posh gambling where the odds are in our favour.
Yeah, just.
What could be better?
Just.
Yeah.
What about on the market? Because this was a sort of Chris Mills' favourite, and it keeps getting largely sold off, I think, on the back of just sort of like some of their sort of long-term shareholders, the estate agents, just dripping stock into the market. And it's just actually got a really rock-solid balance sheet. It's a challenger just for Rightmove, isn't it? It's more the Rightmove. Trades about 8x PE, and it's got cash on the balance sheet.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's one of these baby bathwater situations that in a bear market, you know, everyone just, you can't even get anyone to look at the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, I can tell them, look, it's got 10 million cash in the bank, quarter of the market cap. You know, it's profitable. It's got a really good switched on CEO who's, you know, enhancing the product, the servicing offerings, and on a tech basis, they're trying to build a suite of sort of tech features which are of benefit to estate agents and so on. Nobody's interested. You can say anything, and people will not even listen. And it's often situations like that where you can get your biggest percentage gainers, I find, everybody's written it off. I think it looks really good, and I wouldn't surprise me if somebody comes along and bids for it on the basis that it's sort of it's trying to develop a tech orientated alternative to Rightmove. Well, what if somebody comes along and say, right, let's stick some AI in this, and you know, a private equity group or something might just bid for it, throw 100 million at it, and try and you know, if it even becomes the number two portal, it's currently the number three portal. If it even becomes the number two portal, it could be worth, you know, 10, 20, 30 times the current market cap. Mm. So, and I don't see a lot of downside risk with it either.
Yeah. I mean, Zoopla could buy the thing, couldn't it? You know,
yeah.
if they were allowed by the competition authorities, I'm not sure. But assuming they've already allowed Rightmove to have like 60% of the market, then they should allow somebody else to have a bigger chunk. But hey.
Yeah. So, I don't. It could be one of these things that just, you know, absolutely nothing happens, but it's not burning cash. It is profitable, and you got the upside in for free. So, yeah, I like it on the market.
What about Wilmington, which does sort of like information services for businesses for in the, the regulation side of it and the compliance side of it? And it seems to be doing pretty well. Plenty of cash, trading well.
Yeah, Wilmington just cropped up on one of my small cap reports, and I thought, this looks jolly good. Trading well, reasonable valuation, good outlook, sound balance sheet, So I just wanted to flag it to the listeners. Just some of them might want to have a look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've spoken to a few fund managers, and they all say it's a rock solid business. And then we've got H&T, which is the pawnbroker in the UK, and that seems to be that. I mean, it's that counter cyclical play, I guess. And it's sort of like, you know, it's firing on all cylinders in terms of its pawnbroking business, its pledge book, and its jewelry sales, as well as its Forex.
Yeah, I mean, I always say to people, look, I don't want to own a pawnbroker's, you know, I wouldn't be comfortable with it. But then I realised, actually, if it dropped in price another 20%, I'd probably buy it.
Well, it's 7.5x PE.
Yeah, it's so cheap, isn't it? And you get, I mean, again, I wouldn't particularly feel comfortable getting a dividend from, you know, from financially distressed customers. But again, if the dividend yield went up to 12 or 13%, I'd buy it. So I think the moral argument is BS, basically.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I think if it gets cheap enough, we'll all buy anything. But I mean, I listened to management webinar recently when I was on a, I downloaded it, you know, onto the phone and listened on my headphones on a train. And I thought these people sound really switched on. Mm. They've got various elements to it, as you say. There's the pawnbroking and the foreign exchange and various other things. Yeah, I just think it looks a terrific track record. It's the market leader. I think, was it Albemarle and Bond went yes. under, didn't they? Yeah. So H&T is the survivor, really, and it's got really, really good balance sheet. Mm. Not much borrowings at all. Yeah, I think have a look. If a value investor, definitely have a look at it. I think I don't hold personally, but you know, it does seem to be in a downtrend share price wise. Mm. I don't know why. Mm. So, but it's on my watch list anyway. I might pick some up if it sort of starts forming a bit of a base. I don't know.
Brilliant. Okay, well, fantastic insights, and thanks for your time again, Paul. If anybody wants to sort of like sign up to your you know, the subscription service on Stockopedia, how best to do that?
Oh, we'll just go to stockopedia.com, and there are free trials, you know, 2-week trials there. And obviously there's a wealth of stuff on the site. My articles are just part of the editorial on there. And then my podcasts, if I can just quickly plug those as well, they're on Apple and Google and Spotify and audiobook and everything. So all you do is search for Paul Scott, small caps, and it'll come up. I do a weekend, every weekend I just do a, you know, just a 40-50 minute summary of all the news and trading updates each week in the small, and I love doing them. They're great fun.
I would highlight to investors, I regularly listen to Paul's, and I find them fascinating. So yeah, they're really worth tuning into, no doubt about it. In fact, as I say, I'm pretty sure it must have helped the share price of Plexus this morning, if it's up
25%. Well, I know. I mean, this is the problem. You know, do you mention something that's an absolute nano cap, in that people, you know, even if only a handful of people start buying it, it will affect the price, unfortunately. Mm. But there's nothing I can do about that. All I would say is, whenever I talk about shares and I say I own it, I never, ever sell, you know, shortly afterwards. Yes. Yeah. You know, I think that is crossing the line. I mean, some people, they slip up at some point. You know, some of the Twitter type people, they'll, you know, or you're having lunch with a friend and you loved a particular stock, and you say, oh, how about so-and-so? And he says, oh, no, I sold that one ages ago. Oh, great. Well, thanks for telling me. You know?
Yeah, I know.
So with my stuff, if I'm enthusiastic about it's what you see is what you get. If I'm enthusiastic about a stock, you know, that's because I own it and I'm expecting it to go up a lot. So that's where I am with Plexus. I am not going to touch that one. As I say, I bought 2% of the company. I'm just going to run with it, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why you've done so well. Your integrity comes through in your stock picking, in terms of, you know, you're looking longer term. So, and that's really important. People are the fly-by-night cowboys. They don't long-term. They just fought to get blown out because it just doesn't work. They're just looking for a hit.
They can't remember what they've said, and they contradict themselves. So you know, it's very easy to spot that type, really.
But also these people effectively choose stocks where they feel as though they can get a pop on the shares.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Whereas you choose and I choose stocks whereby we feel there's a good long-term investment story behind it, and therefore the quality of the selection is likely to be higher than if you're going for a short-term, ramp and pump and dump in it.
Yeah, yeah, no, there is a lot of that. I mean, I don't generally even look at that end of the market. You know, I mean, it's very unusual for me to go as low as the market cap on Plexus, but I just think there could be an opportunity there. We don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I can't get volume. So that's an area that I can't play in anymore. Anyway, thanks fair again, enough. Paul, and look
pleasure.
Forward to in touch with base in about 3 months' time.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Paul. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Bye for now.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.